Hey guys, just before we get into the episode, I wanted to remind you that you can find me on YouTube, Facebook and Instagram. You can also find the Maladjusted Monkeys podcast on YouTube, Facebook and Instagram as well. So go over and support the guys and show some love. This episode is going to kickstart what is going to be called the Rifles and Sirens podcast segment on the main K4301 podcast. It's just talking to ex-military, current military, and EMS workers about their time in service, the trials and tribulations that they face on a day-to-day basis, how they develop PTSD, depression, what triggers that sort of stuff in their profession, and how they deal with the problems afterwards. And we're really hoping that these episodes and people that are giving this information, reaching out, can help others in identifying certain issues that they might be having themselves so that they can start getting the help that they really need, and also to give each other the tools in dealing with these issues as well. So you might not relate entirely with their story, but you may relate to somebody else's. So that's why we've got more people coming on in the future. So if you or your a friend of yours has a story that they would like to share or share their experiences in those fields, please don't hesitate to contact me at mancave4301@gmail.com. Alternately, you can go to Facebook and send me a message on there, and also Instagram. So without further ado, let's get into the podcast.
I'm Tommy.
I'm Shay.
We're the Maladjusted Monkeys.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Man Cave 4301 podcast. I'm your host, Big Kev. I'm here with Tommy and Shane from the Maladjusted Monkeys. Thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Mate, thanks for having us.
Yeah, appreciate it.
How would you like to do this? Do you want to do two episodes, one for each, or did you want to...
Mate, we can...
Up to you, man.
Yeah, I'm happy to just splice it all in. Like, our stories are very the same, so we did everything pretty much together, so yeah.
All right, let's give this a bash. All right, so we'll start off with the question that starts off every podcast. Why did you join the military?
God.
Well, for me... I grew up, and I always, it was two things for me that I was going to do ever since I was a kid, either be a police officer or be a soldier. And after I left high school, I think I went, right, I'm going to try to join the coppers. And at the time, you needed a tertiary education and go to uni and stuff. And there was a bit that said on the website, but if you're ex-military, then we'll waive that and you can come on in. And I went, right, well, I may as well just go join the infantry, do my time in the army, then join the coppers. So that's what I did. And... yeah, haven't looked back since. That's basically what I'm doing now. I'm in the coppers now. Did 4 years in the Australian infantry and 5 years in the police now. So, yeah, that's why I joined it. I was always going to be either a copper or a soldier. Luckily, I got to do both. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't just a stepping stone. Yeah, was it something you were fairly interested in?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, from about age of eight, I always wanted to be in the army and be a police officer. And, yeah, I'm just lucky enough to be able to have done both now. Yeah.
Nice.
So I got a pretty strong family background in the military, so like on both sides, grandparents who served in World War One, World War Two, my grandfather was in Vietnam, so I kind of just grew up with it, and I just always wanted to be, looking at who my grandfather was, he was a pretty big role model for me, so I always wanted to join the army, especially the infantry, because that's what he was, despite his advice that probably wasn't the best career choice, so yeah, it worked out in the end though.
So was he the only one that was against it, or?
Oh no, he was pretty keen for me to join the army, just he thought I could do better than the infantry. Yeah,
infantry or nothing, right?
Yeah, infantry or nothing, mate. That's what I set out with. Yeah.
Nice. So where do you sign up?
So I think I pretty much it was all done over the phone. So I did like a very cursory bit of research on the internet about, or on the army site, what was the go, and then call them up, make your appointment to go to Defence Force Recruiting Center, and you go there, do, I don't know what they call it now, I think it was called Joe's Day.
Yeah, yeah,
and Joe's Day. You do your aptitude testing, you talk to a career advisor and a psych, yep, and different things. So, yeah, it's a pretty easy process.
Yeah, nice. So you join up, and whereabouts do they send you?
Once you join up, you go do your basic training at Kapooka and Wagga Wagga, and is that 12?
12 weeks.
Yeah, 12 weeks where you learn just basic soldiering skills. So basic how to use a rifle, how to do drill, how to carry yourself like a soldier, basic field skills. And so it's 12 weeks of basic training. And then after that, everyone heads off to their employment training. So for me and Shane, because we joined the infantry, after our 12 weeks of basic training, we head off to the School of Infantry in Singleton, also known as the School of Cool. And that's where we learn how to be a rifleman, basically. And how long is that? That's
another 12 weeks.
Is that 12 weeks? Yeah, 12 weeks of learning infantry skills. Okay, so a lot more weapons and tactics. And after that, yeah, you head to your battalion. So for me, 6 RAR, for Shane,
6 RAR.
6 RAR as well at Anogra in Brisbane.
Nice. Yeah. Is basic training really that basic, or is it the typical screaming as you get off the bus and
all that sort of stuff? There's just lots of screaming, and it's just jarring because you're not used to it. But really, it really is quite basic, because like a lot of the stuff you're learning is like just how to look after yourself as a human being. So like there's guys there who'd never mopped or swept a floor before, didn't know how to clean a toilet or anything like that. So
you have a lesson on shaving the first night. I remember. I remember in my platoon, it was given by a female instructor. She put the shaving cream on, and I was like, this chick is hard as nails. Did that. And I think they give you a lesson on like how to shower yourself as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so it is.
How to iron your uniform.
So it is basic skills.
So basic training is basic stuff.
Yeah. Like, well, you've got to remember they're smashing you down to the lowest common denominator to rebuild you again. I remember when I got off the bus, it felt like the classic scene from the movie. It was pissing down with rain and they're just yelling at us to get off this bus, and you're standing there all formed up, you know, in your civvies, not knowing what's going on. I think that first night when I went to bed, I was like, man, I have made a big mistake here. I was like, is this really what I want to do? But then you get used to the yelling, because you know it's a game. At the end of it, you know, they'll yell at you for anything, even though you're not really messing up. They're going to yell at you and break you down and rebuild you to, you know, think the way you need to think as a soldier.
Yep. Yeah.
And then when you go to the School of Infantry, it happens again. All right, you've learnt the basic skills. We're going to break you down again, and now we're going to teach you how to be an infantry soldier.
Yeah. Knock the basic stuff out. And then...
pretty much. And build on it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, it's... When a civilian goes to Kapooka and learns the basic training, I think if you ask a civilian who's halfway through training, how basic is it or what's it like, they'll say, oh, this is full on. This is the hardest thing I've ever done. When you ask an infantry soldier once he's finished, you know, Singleton, or even if he's at the School of Infantry, what was basic training like? They'll go, mate, that was a breeze. That was nothing compared to this. And then same thing, you ask soldiers at battalion and they laugh at like Wagga Wagga, Kapooka. You're like, yeah, that was the easiest thing you've ever done.
Yeah. Slowly graduated, like going up through those steps. And it's the same for like CAV and other combat roles and things like that. They have a much similar experience. Like I remember we were marching down to PT or something, and I was in the back right hand of the file marching down, and I was what's called square gating. So instead of swinging my arms alternatively with my legs, my left arm was swinging with my left leg, my right arm was swinging with my leg. It's called square gating. And my sergeant was just beasting me, like, stop fucking square gating. Sorry, do you mind if we swear?
Or? Go for it, man.
Okay, cool. so just getting into me. So, what did he tell me? He's like, stop swinging your arms. Okay, now swing your arms again. I kept square gating. He's like, do you even know what fucking square gating is? I'm like, no, sergeant. He's like, oh, shit, that's right. You're a new course. Yeah, it's this. And then, like, yeah. So for them, because they just pump out people courses one after another, so for them it's a fucking blur as well.
And that's the thing, like, it's just marching is just walking. But when you get to the army, you forget how to walk. And then you do this thing, yeah, like Shane said, called square gating. You're like, it's like you're one of those Thunderbird puppets on a string. And it makes no sense. I remember the first night when, yeah, they were basically teaching us how to march. And I was in the front row. And I remember Corporal Brendan Hope, he listens to our show actually, so he'll enjoy this. I mean, he got right in my face. He's like, it's not a fucking runway, sunshine. I'm like, I don't know what that means. Isn't it? I'm just walking, aren't I?
Oh, shit. Were there any people in there that just didn't get it? Like, yeah, some shirt fillers, as we like to call them?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. I specifically remember a bloke who, probably day two or three, he must have realised this wasn't for him. And his whole family was in the army, I remember. And because once you're there, you can't just put your hand up and say, I quit, and that's it. I think yeah. They've got you for how long? You've got to do the whole course, don't you? Can you remember?
You're in for 4 years.
Yeah, you're in for 4 years. So you can't just say, this isn't for me. They're like, no, you've signed for 4 years, so we will have you for 4 years unless something drastic happens.
And I remember you're under 18, then your parents can.
Yeah.
Remove you.
And I remember he must have realised, yep, this is definitely not for me. So he started making up a story about his family members being sick and things like that, and just expected that no one would follow up on it. He even got one of my mates to help write a letter to the commanding officer why he should, why he should be allowed to leave, and got him to write, family members got cancer, dad's sick.
This guy went to lengths.
Right? And we all believed him too. I remember believing him. And then I remember a few days after he wrote the letter, we were out having, must have been one of our first weapons drills out in the scrub. And, and I don't think I've told you this story. And a vehicle pulled up and it was like the military police with our sergeant, our platoon sergeant. And they've called old mate out and got all of us to line up. And they just beasted this bloke. They're like, take a good hard look at this guy, man. And we're like, what is going on? They're like, he stated his family sick, said this, this, and this. It's all bullshit. He doesn't deserve to wear this uniform. He doesn't deserve to be around here. Take a good hard look at him. You'll never see him again. All of a sudden, he just bolted into the scrub. He just bolted into the scrub. I don't know where he was going, but he bolted in the scrub. And I remember the sergeant looked at the two corporals and he just went, get him. So they sprinted off and we're standing there and he's like, it was like watching like two greyhounds after like a really slow rabbit. And one was on the left, one was on the right. And I remember he was running and he looked back and he's like, you can't touch me. And one went high, one went low and boom, straight to the ground. And we never saw him again. Yeah, that was it. So I don't know how his movie ended, but who knows what he's doing now.
It obviously wasn't well.
Yeah, yeah.
Holy shit.
So yeah, you're going to get guys like that. Did you have any guys in your platoon at basic like that?
Yeah, but they all end up going off to their chosen jobs and, I don't know, maybe they came good in the end. Like, some people it takes a little bit longer to integrate into that
culture.
It can take some people a little bit of time, but then after that, once you adjust to it, it becomes normal everyday life. Other people just, for whatever reason, just adapt to it really quickly and,
Some people that we get that basic training, like the little things that people just don't get, and they never will.
Yeah,
with genetics, I don't know.
Yeah. I think you're going to get that in any job, really.
For sure.
Yeah, I think it just with the military, it stands out so much more because it is such a culture shock and it's a change. Like, it's not normal behavior. Like, the way you taught at basic training, like, you are relearning every little thing about you. And everyone, you're basically starting off on an even playing field. It's like, this is the type of person you will be at basic training, so you'll all be like that.
Mm.
And if you can't conform to that, it stands out, yeah. Like, old mate who tried running away into the scrub. Like, I don't know where he was going. I remember there was another bloke, actually, who left in the middle of the night. Again, definitely wasn't for him. And he was a strange one. He packed all his bags. Somehow he got past everyone and walked to the front gate, which is miles away from where we were, and said, do you mind calling me a cab so I can go home? And they're like, yeah, no worries. They just called the MP. They came pick him up, brought him straight back.
while I was at TSP, Training Support Platoon at
Singleton?
At Singo, we had a guy who had done the runner, gotten away, and the story that we were told was that it'd been a few months and they were trying to find him, couldn't find him. They were pretty sure he was at his mum's place and she denied that he was there. So eventually they just sent him a letter to his mother saying, look, can you just get him to sign these papers so we can discharge him from the army, rah, rah, rah. And I think she called him up and said, oh, yeah, yeah, sweet, just send him here, he's here, rah, rah, rah.
So
he just rocked up. Because I remember they pulled up with him and they threw him in the cells for a couple of days. And then as soon as they let him out of the cells to join back in with the platoon, he was gone that night, like, just run off again.
Wow. Fugitive from the army.
Yeah. We've all thought about it.
Yeah, 100%.
You think about it. I remember when we were at the School of Infantry, like, you'd get smashed all week, but you had your weekends off. So it's common for everyone to go to Newcastle on your weekends. And, you know, you've got disposable income, your early 20s, hanging out with your mates, you've done hard training all week, and then you've got the run of Newcastle to yourself for a whole weekend, drinking alcohol all weekend. Then it comes to that Sunday, because you've got to be back Sunday night. Sunday arvo, you're sitting there thinking, you're normally sitting in a bar going, you know, it'd be easy to just stay here and not go back. You know, you do it every weekend. I used to think that. But I stayed.
Well, that was actually one of the questions that I was going to ask is, was there at any time that you regretted what you were doing? But it seems that there was a little bit of regret at different intervals.
Yeah, like...
Not so much. I don't think it's regret so much as constantly questioning, like, is this worth it? Is this really what I want to do?
When do you sort of start seeing it pay off?
Probably after a couple of years you've been at your battalion.
it takes a little while. Anyone listening who's gone through training, just stay with it. Yeah. You'll get there.
Yeah, eventually.
It's, I reckon, defining moment for me anyway, I'd say you'd be the same, Shane, is when you get Don't talk to me. That green light for a deployment. Once you get told you're going overseas, then you go, well, this is what I've trained for.
Yeah.
You know, and then when you get boots on the ground, you're like, yeah, this is worth it. You know, the 3-4 years I've been training and getting smashed. Yeah, it's worth
it. I think it's even before that. Like, once you get posted to your unit after you've finished all your training and you start to develop those relationships and close bonds with people in your unit, that's when, like, a lot of the stuff that you worried about before just becomes water off a duck's back, because your support network's even bigger. You're learning more about the organization. You're getting more confident in your own skills and things like that.
You also built that brotherhood as well.
Yeah.
Like, because you've been through it all together. And
Well, that's an interesting thing, because once you get to your battalion and you start going doing field exercises and doing real tough exercises where you're out field for 2-3 weeks in the scrub, even though you're over it, and like, that's the thing with soldiers, like, we can be in the worst situation, we're going to complain non-stop about it, but we're still going to do the job.
That's the digger's right.
Exactly. We're going to complain the whole time, but we'll get the job done. And no matter how bad it is out field, like, I think me and Shane have spoke about this before, like, we'd see each other at scrub and all we'd do is just start making fun of each other and trying to bring each other's morale down, but we're actually lifting it by making fun of each other, and that's what makes it worth it. Like, you wouldn't change a thing.
Nah.
Even though it's shit conditions, you're out there with your brothers and it makes it worth it. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing too. Like, you tend to see that people in the military, they make the best out of a bad situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'd have to. Otherwise you just go mad.
Yeah.
And that's where, like, a digger's sense of humour comes into play. Like,
the dark sense of humour. Dark.
Yeah, it's real dark, but that's the way it has to be, because...
Is it darker than your coffee?
And that's pretty dark, mate. That's pretty dark. Yeah, I'd say it'd be on par, if not darker. Yeah.
Well, that's a good segue, actually, to getting your assignments and deployments and all that sort of stuff. So you're in 6RAR. When's the first time that you get deployed?
So we got there 2010. You would have got there late 2009.
To the battalion?
Yeah.
Early 2010.
Yeah. Yep. So it wasn't until start of 2012 that we first got rumblings that they were going to take drivers and crew commanders for the Bushmasters to deploy with 3RAR. So we didn't actually go with our unit. And then slowly... lists start to form on who's going on the trip, lists change, people get cut, people get put back on.
Classic, nothing ever goes to plan.
No, exactly.
You don't feel safe till you're over there, basically. 100%. Yeah.
Like, poor old Curto, one of our best mates. I think hands down would probably be the
best
one of the best soldiers we've ever met. Yeah. Was meant to be on a going over on a different kind of trip to us, but at the same time with Was it a special?
Yeah, he was going to be attached to Special Forces.
Got pulled off of that, was meant to be coming with us then got pulled off of that, and then, you know, without naming names, there were some people who came over with us that should not have been there.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, he misses out. It's pretty shitty.
So you had some issues getting your deployment, is that right? Or was that the...
No.
Like it was just getting changed around, or...?
Yeah, on the lead-up, so I did my pre-deployment training. We did it in Townsville. So I knew I was going, and then I did all my lead-up training with, I think it was Bravo Company. So we're like, I trained for, how long was pre-deployment, Shane?
Oh, God.
A couple of months in Townsville. Sure. And so I did it with a certain platoon. I got used to our tactics and how everyone moved and, you know, our drills basically. And then at the last minute, some changes got made, and they said, all right, you're not going to be with them. You're going to be with these guys now. And by the way, they leave for Afghanistan in 2 weeks, when before that I was going to leave in about 6-7 weeks. I had all these plans with my ex-girlfriend who, we booked in holiday before we went to Afghanistan. Then I had to ring her and say, hey, this is while I'm in Townsville. I'm like, hey.
Love you.
I hope you enjoyed your day. Just, I've got to tell you something. I'm not leaving in 6-7 weeks. I'm leaving in 2 weeks now, so I can't go on that holiday with you. So I'll be back next week. We'll say our goodbyes, and then I'm off. So that was tough because I hadn't trained with this group before, and the first time I'd really be getting to know them is over in Afghanistan, because we'd already finished all our field training, and it was just the prep now to go overseas. So for me, it was a little bit daunting because I'm like, I don't really know where I fit in here or what these guys are like. And then when I got overseas on the first nursery patrol that I was going to be leading, they're like, oh, yeah, that's, by the way, you're going to lead this nursery patrol now, which...
What's a nursery patrol?
Sorry, it's like when you get into country over in Afghanistan, the guys that are leaving country will go out on patrol with the guys that are coming in, show them the ropes.
Like an induction.
Yeah, basically an induction.
Okay.
I was doing an induction, and before the mission, they're like, oh, yeah, you'll be the lead crew commander. So the vehicle out the front, I'll be in charge of the navigation and everything. Looking at my map, not seeing Afghanistan before, trying to figure it out.
No way.
And the guy that was meant to be helping me with my induction, he was in the back of the car basically sleeping. He's like, mate, any issues, I'll be down here. Because I'm standing out of the hatch of the Bushmaster with my map. And he's like, I'll just be down here if you need me. Just call out if you need anything. Just I'm like,
fake it till you make it.
Yeah, I'm looking at my map, looking at the terrain going, this doesn't make any sense at all. I'm like, yeah, and it was a nightmare, that first one. So, but... God. I was on my deployment. I, you know, got to do what I trained to do. So I was happy with that.
Yeah, right. So your first, when you get deployed, your boots on the ground, what's the environment like? What are your first thoughts?
Because the first thing, you don't actually fly straight into country. You first stop off at the UAE.
Yeah.
United Arab Emirates, at a Air Force base there, and you do a little, like, zero your weapons, make sure your scopes and everything good like that, some final first aid training, care of the battle casualty, things like that. So that's a bit, it's more you're just, like, pumped up, like, just ready to go, hurry up, let's do this, because there's a lot of admin crap that has to go on in the background.
Absolutely.
So then when the day finally comes, you jump on your plane, you've got your weapon there, it's all getting pretty real. You're flying in.
Did you get the speech in the airport hangar before you left by that colonel? It was like, you're part of history, gentlemen.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, you get really? That, the General Patton speech? Wow. You get the goosebumps, you're like, man.
The pump up.
Yeah, this is real.
Yeah, yep. So flying in, and I don't like flying, but it was frigging awesome. I don't do roller coasters either.
Yep.
Same. But the, because you come in really high, obviously, so they can't target you with rockets or anything like that. And, what they'll do is they'll do that for as long as possible to the last safe moment, and then they'll just drop as quickly as possible to then land the plane.
And they've rocked. So
can we just go back, last safe moment? None of that probably sounds safe.
The last safe moment is probably the Normanby. The safe moment before we left, although the Normanby's not even that safe.
Well, it wasn't the Normanby. I think it was the other one.
Plowing?
Yeah, I got kicked out of there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Three times in a row.
That's right. That.
But anyway, so yeah, that's a bit, that was, for me anyway, it was really freaking exciting, which was weird because I don't like flying. But you finally land and like, yeah, you chomp at the bit, let's do this, and then more admin. So, yeah, righto, guys, come into the hangar. I'm going to hand you out your key, your room keys while you stay here at Tarrant Cow. Here's some do's and don'ts, you know, like just more admin crap. And that just, yeah, so it's not until, I know, it'd be different for you because you stay at TK, but then it wasn't until we actually got on our nursery patrol, which was moving out to the forward operating base that I was posted to, that it all kind of starts to get quite real. But even then, like the whole, the whole time, I won't go into it, but it's weird how mundane it is. Like the mixture of excitement with just the everyday mundanity of it all. It's weird.
Okay. So
you're really pumped up, but then it's just this constant like rising of adrenaline, quickly brought back down by like, okay guys, we've got to do this now, like some kind of paperwork or it's weird.
When did it finally happen, when you get to go out of the wire, outside the wire? It's just,
well, for me, yeah, that was my first time out of Tarrant Cow, was driving to my forward patrol base. So then that was, oh god, however many kilometers, 10, 15, I think, something like that.
Yeah, and I think my first time outside the wire was maybe day two or three in country. Maybe, yeah, probably day two. And it feels like there's a lot to learn straight away.
It's a lot of new sights, a lot of new sounds. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, you do all your training in Australia, so you're used to the Australian terrain, and we can mock up kind of what to expect. You know, we build villages and people role play. But when you get there, it looks completely different to what you're expecting.
And there's a lot more people.
A lot more people than you expect in the villages, and the terrain makes no sense. Like, you'll be in the middle of the desert for kilometres. There's no one there. Then a goat herder will be walking through the desert. And all of a sudden you'll go down a dip and it'll be this lush greenery.
Yeah.
Wow.
Drive into that for like 30 seconds and come out the other side and you're back in the desert again. Like, it's really strange.
It's bizarre.
So it's like the green zones just kind of snake, or the river systems running through. So it's just these giant belts of green running through. It's incredible. It's really beautiful.
It's one of the things that, like I was saying on the Hazard Ground podcast, a lot of them say it's one of the most beautiful places in hell.
It'd be a great place if people weren't trying to kill you.
So run us through a normal day. What are your duties? What is it, just patrolling?
I would have pretty busy days. So my job was basically to...
So first things first, you would have woken up, had a shower.
I know where this is
going. Straight to green beans.
Yeah. So I had the base, I was at Tarrant Cow, so it was, I had quite a luxurious place to stay. I'd wake up in the morning, I'd go eat brekkie at the mess, and then we'd normally have one or two jobs on that day. So for me, a job would be, we'd be going out to a village, to take people to have a meeting, or for engineers to look at a bridge or something, to basically help build infrastructure. And a lot of my role was essentially providing close protection for those people on those jobs. So I think in the end we ended up, for the 6th month diploma, I did just over 250 of those. So most days we had a job on. If we didn't have a job on, then you're just sitting around with your mates, either working on the vehicles, cleaning your weapons, going to the gym, or watching movies. That's pretty much it. A lot, modern war is, it's all about how much space you've got in your hard drive.
Yeah.
And getting movies, TV shows, porn off each other, and that's pretty much it.
He didn't get any porn.
Shane didn't do that. Yes. We were the same. It's like a lot of maintenance, making sure your gear's good to go. It's so strange, the mundanity. I'm not even saying
that. Is that a word?
Yeah, I'm not saying that right.
It is now.
How mundane a lot of it actually is. And even when you go out on a patrol or to an Overwatch, you just do workouts and stuff, just sit there, chill out. And it's not... I don't know.
It just becomes so normal.
Yeah.
Like, when we look at our deployment, we're like, well, we haven't really done what we've trained to do. You know, infantry soldier, you know, we train for the loudest fight, you know, that's what we want. And then modern war for us over there, it's, like you said, it's very mundane, like a lot of hurry up and wait, sitting around. And that's basically it, you know. Like, I watched Band of Brothers last week, and I was like, fuck, this wasn't my deployment. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's completely different. No, you don't want that deployment. You know, you don't want to be in the Battle of the Bulge. But, like, yeah, most of the time, when I think back on my deployment, the most of the memories I have, what we're talking about before, the brotherhood, the sitting around with the boys when you clean your weapons or kitting up, or, you know, just sitting in an Overwatch position, just talking shit, really.
Mm.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, like, there was some random stuff too. Like, up the back, we had a half range set up where you could go and fire your weapon system, zero your weapon system, things like that. And I remember one day, there was a bunch of goats caught up in the barbed wire right up the back, and we're just up there trying to cut goats out of barbed wire.
Oh, God.
What else? I can't really think of anything else.
Yeah, I know. Like, I'm saying it out loud, man, it was boring. But it really wasn't, you know what I mean? Like, it's just because you have an expectation as an infantry soldier of what an Afghan, or what a war deployment is going to be, and it isn't that. It's something completely different. It's still an important job, obviously, but...
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to bring that up, that it doesn't really matter what you're doing there, it's helping. Like, it's,
yeah, that's right.
It's still all a part of it.
Part of the big picture. You know.
Yeah, but on the other side of the token, like you said, you train and it's like going to uni for 4 years to be a psychologist and you end up flipping burgers.
Yeah, 100%.
I think the hardest thing for us is the deployments that happened before us. So 6RIR had deployed in 2010 and they lost a few guys and there were some big contacts that happened on their deployment. So we compare, me and Shane compare our deployments to the ones that have happened before us, which is silly to do because we don't feel like we've earned our medals or anything like that when we come home. So that's kind of where we sit with it a little bit, hey?
Yeah.
So neither of you saw combat at all?
I did.
He got rounds off.
Yeah, so I was in...
The closest I shot some dude with a pen flare. that's about it, really.
Yeah, so yeah. I was in one contact. I wouldn't call the first one a contact. It was...
Was this all in the same day?
No. There's a couple of different days spaced over a couple of, I think, a month on two different times. We were at this one patrol base where we were mentoring the Afghan National Army. The first time, that was pretty exciting. There was like a few rounds shot at us and, I won't go into too much detail, but, nothing really happened. But from the fire that was returned, you'd think it was like the biggest thing since Ben Hur, like maybe a bit of
everyone was just looking to get off rounds.
Okay.
And then the second one, we were, meant to be leaving that patrol base to move back to our patrol base, and just as we were about to depart, we're all lined up, ready to go, the ANA, or Afghan National Army Patrol, was coming back in. They started getting engaged from a small feature just across from the patrol base, so we basically turned around, formed up, and assaulted to provide them support while they came back in, and yeah.
Can you run us through the whole process of it, like...
So, I guess, yeah, so we were at the back of the patrol base, lined out, ready to move, northwest, I think it was, back to our patrol base. The ANA patrol was coming in from the opposite direction, whatever that would be, southeast.
Good soldiering, mate.
Yeah, thanks. If we use mill.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we basically, did a turnaround, formed up into like an extended line, and just bounded forward in our vehicles, providing covering fire as they came back in. I don't really remember. It's so fuzzy in my mind. There's only a few things that really stand out, but I think there was I don't think there was that many RPGs, but there's like some machine gun fire targeting us. But the only thing that really stands out in my mind is when I actually had to reload my weapon system. I had a 50 caliber machine gun, and Yeah. Oh, God, I love
And you had thing. The PWS,
which is a, oh, God, I can't remember what it stands for, but essentially it's like playing Call of Duty. Like, I've got a little TV screen inside the vehicle with a joystick, and I can control it all remotely and zoom in and whatnot. So fire and array, click, 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 and it takes you a second to go to run through your drills. You're like, oh, it's out of ammo. And, like, the best thing for me was just, this is my favourite moment. It was without even thinking, like, those drills is just so instinctual. Boom, like, lift the hatch up, fucking feed tray up, and then, I won't say that, but, yeah, someone's feeding me liners up, so just standing on top of this vehicle while rounds are coming
anything
in.
Anything goes, man, anything goes.
Yeah, I'm just, because I'm still in, I've got to be a little bit careful about what I say. So, yeah, like, but, yeah, standing on top of that vehicle with rounds coming in, that was, yeah, that was pretty cool.
What goes through your mind when you hear that first shot ring out and you think it's game on?
The first time, it's just disbelief. You're like, was that
what I thought?
Because it was nowhere, like, because we were at the back of the patrol base, so it was nowhere near us. It didn't land anywhere near us, but it's like, does that sound like gunfire? Like, what the hell is that? And all of a sudden it's like, oh, stand two. And everyone's just running around like headless chooks. It's a bit chaotic and a bit disorganized, especially when it's your first contact. And you kind of just waiting for someone to grip the situation up. And once that happens and the officers and the sergeants and the section commanders do that, it all kind of just almost rolls into what your training was, and you just go through the motions of what you were taught during your training. So you don't, in the moment, you don't have a lot of time to reflect on what's happening at that time. It's just very instinctual. But then afterwards, once the adrenaline wears off, I don't know, even then I didn't really think about it that much. I was like, good times, go on.
I remember when you told me about it, when you come back into base, I got rounds off. And I'm like, motherfucker, I haven't gotten rounds off yet.
One of the craziest things to me was after that, because there was a compound nearby, and it just really brought home how normal it was for the locals who lived there for gunfights and things to happen, because not even half an hour later after it was done and we were back at the patrol base, there would have been about 6 or 7 kids who just started playing soccer at the front of that compound like it was nothing, like nothing had gone on. It was, yeah, it was bizarre to see. But they're tough little bastards.
Well, yeah, they've been looking at war for, well, God knows how
decades,
long.
Decades, yeah.
Decades. Yeah, so it's normal for them.
Yeah. They grew up with it.
Like, yeah.
Every generation there has grown up with war. So
wow.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel when you see these kids running around? Like,
I remember it was the first time I saw how they were living and everything. It was pretty sad because it is so, it's very primitive, you know, and they really have nothing. And you go to these small villages and, yeah, they have nothing, and like there's, you basically, if you're a male, you grow up to what, basically be a farmer, essentially. Yeah. That's basically it. And if you're a female, you have kids. That's it. And then you watch the kids and they're playing with rocks or toys that, you know, or the forces that have come through give them, you know.
It is a bit different depending on where they are. So like they're like in some of the bigger cities there are universities and things before. I'm so bad with the history of it, but before, I think it was the Mujahideen had gotten into power, it was a very, a lot more, a liberal country where women were able to get educated. They weren't required to wear the full face veils and things like that, but so it can be quite difficult, like, depending on whether it's a city or if it's rural, but yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I just remember the first time I saw the tiny villages. I was like, man, this is sad.
Mm.
But like I said, then, like, TK, Tarancourt, the actual city, it's only a few kilometres from the nearest small village.
Yeah.
And they live a little bit differently.
Yeah.
And it's not even that far away. Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that's probably one of the things that has affected, one of the things that's really affected me since coming back, in terms of, like, how I want to live my life, thinking about, like, how... I always call it like an existential crisis, like what's the point of everything or anything. Like seeing kind of how cold and unjust the universe is, like if I was born there, I'd be doing the same things they were. Like, it's only because I got lucky and I was born in Australia that I got to be on that side of the conflict rather than, you know, potentially being bribed or threatened into fighting for the Taliban or something like that. And especially with the kids, like, I didn't want to have kids. I didn't want to, I'm always trying to, like, get rid of as much of my crap as possible and just trying to live with, like, as little stuff as possible. I hate having heaps of stuff around me and things like that. Yeah, that just really affected me a lot.
Yeah.
You wouldn't just, like, a minimalist sort of...
Yeah, yeah. Like, I just want to have, like, I want to... Madison gets the shits, but I just want to get a single 20-foot shipping container and just live
he's
in that.
I like. Again. Still, yeah. Yeah. What Shane wants to start is a cult.
No more trinkets for Madison. No more trinkets. There's too much shit on the walls.
100%.
Like, stop going to Kmart and stop buying furniture.
But yeah, just get back to, I guess.
You've just seen how simple they live.
Yeah, yeah. And I think people can be happier that way. But each to their own, whatever. But
I totally agree. Like, we are built up in this society where everything that we have, all the technology that's been made, has been made to make our lives easier.
Yeah,
you know, and we just have so much of it that if you go over there, what you see over there for them as this minimalist. Is normal.
Yeah, it's
normal. Like, yeah. And we can't wrap your head around it. Like,
yeah.
How do they do with so little?
Yeah.
You know? Mm. Yeah, I couldn't imagine.
A lot of them don't want change at all because that's, like you said, that's what they're used to.
Yeah.
They don't know what anything else would be. So when you're happy with what you have, why you don't need all this other stuff?
So, well, let's be honest. Like, I don't think Instagram or Facebook has made anyone any happier.
Yeah, that's true. I agree with that.
No.
No.
No. Actually, Casey Meredith brought up a good point when him and Madman Brad come over. And he said, you can see these people on Instagram with their beautiful pictures. And he said, they're miserable underneath.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Right. In real life, you meet them and they're just miserable people.
Mm. Yep. No one's going to put up a picture of them being miserable, you know. It's going to be
or if it is, it's going to have a filter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I could put a picture of me up crying, but you know, it's going to be in black and white.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to look good. Artistic. It's going to look good.
Yeah.
Hello, darkness.
Oh shit! So your deployments finish. You both come back over at the same time. Were you guys based together or?
No, we were, how many times did we actually get to see each other in Afghanistan?
Like 3 times.
Yeah, only 3 times where he'd come back to Tarinkout, they'd need a resupply or something. Mm. So we were, completely different places when we were in country. And then I got back to Australia before Shane did by a couple of weeks, maybe?
Yeah, I think so.
Not that long, yeah. I think I got back in November or late October. And then a few weeks later, Shane came back. Yeah. I wish I could remember the dates. But yeah, we're like, and then as soon as he was back, straight back to hanging out all the time. Because, I felt like I didn't see you at all that whole deployment. He's my best mate, and I didn't even really get to see him. Just 3 times.
Yeah.
Aww.
I think I wept it a little bit. How was your transition back into civilian life?
Ooh, Shane, you go first on this one.
Oh, God. At first it was exciting to be getting out of the army, like perceived explosion of freedom, like being able to grow a beard and not go to work every day and do whatever the hell you want. Like, we still a little bit cashed up from our trip, and you know, there's just so much opportunity and freedom to go and do whatever the hell we wanted. So it was really exciting at the start. I think pretty much straight away, one of the first things we did was we did a trip over to Ireland for a couple of weeks and Germany for a couple of days, but we ended up coming back home early because I just didn't compare to Ireland.
And we ran out of money.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
Probably one of the main factors.
Yeah, big factor, yeah.
But then I think once the reality of like, oh shit, this money's running out, I've got to find some work, once that starts setting in, you kind of start going through a bit of, because you're not seeing your best mates. Like, that's the beauty of the army, is like you're going to work every day with your best mates. And then all of a sudden, like, especially if you move away from where you were based, you're all of a sudden on your own. You can't really, well, for me, I can't speak from my personal experience, but it was hard for me to even talk to some of my best civvy friends, even just a normal conversation, because the shared lingo that we have and the way that we communicate and we have a lot of the same opinions on things, it's hard to do that with even with your old civvy mates. It starts to build up over time, and you can't really pinpoint one, like you're drinking more .
Was it a drink to forget sort of thing, or was it a drink to remember, or?
Think at first it's just because you're bored. I think for me it was like, I've got nothing else to do, I'm bored. So actually, you know what? I never actually thought about like drink to remember, but because like I've always said, like there's not a lot of things I'm ever trying to forget. It's definitely a drink to remember sometimes, like when I just want to get written off and I guess wallow in my own self-pity. It's to remember things and to be able to feel those things, because most of the time I don't ever think about it. I just push it down, don't feel it, don't worry about it, don't talk about it. So it's like those times, is like, and that's why it can end up being quiet.
Which is that classic mentality that we're trying to break people out of too.
Yeah, 100%. Exactly.
And I've noticed, like, in the last few years, anytime me, Shane, and some of our other army mates get together, when we do have a big drinking session, it everyone gets a bit emotional and just wants to talk about the good old days, you know? And the next day I hate it. I'm like, because I just feel depressed afterwards.
Yeah.
Or even during as well. Like, I'm aware we're all doing it. And I'm like, we can't keep doing this every time we catch up, is just drink and talk about the old days, you know? None of us are in. Well, you're back in now.
Yeah.
But all the other boys are out and we all just talk about the good old days from, like 8 years ago now.
You find the same stories sort of crop up and you just think going through the motions.
Yeah, 100%.
Yep. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Which is what, I guess, and that's what I started finding, I guess, recently, is with doing the podcast and even some of the civilian friends that I've started gravitating towards were ones who are like self-starting and self-motivated, who, like one of my best mates, Flynn, he's basically taught himself how to do photography, and now he's starting his own business with that, and people like that, because of Sean Barry.
Yep.
It's an opportunity to start creating new stories and have new experiences that are, you know, just as, or if not more enjoyable and whatnot, instead of, again, like dwelling in the past. And I think it was Jennings, our old CEO of 6RR, said when he was leaving, like, you know, be proud of what you've done overseas, but don't live in the desert. Mm. Like, yeah. There's going to be more things to do with your life than just the couple of months you spent in Afghanistan.
So now it's about creating new memories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With the same people.
Yeah.
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 Yep. That's right. And that's what a lot of guys struggle with, is adjusting to civilian life, having that purpose, because the military culture, you are living it. It's not just a job. It is your life. So we would train, you know, normal hours, Monday to Friday. And then after that, like when you'd finish, you'd still be hanging around your mates. If you lived on base, like Shane lived on base, he was still in that environment. He'd walk into his room, there's army stuff everywhere. You're talking to other army boys about what you did during the day, or deployments and stuff like that. Or I lived off base, and pretty much every second night, our group of mates would come around my house, and, you know, someone would take a turn at cooking dinner, but we were still around the same group of boys.
Or I'd come around after work when you were doing your own PT, and I was not doing that. I was not doing PT my own time, so I just buy a six-pack, pull up a chair and just watch you do PT while I was sipping beer.
Yeah.
That's my man.
Yeah. So, like, that is your culture, and if you just do your contract, which is 4 years, the big picture, 4 years is nothing. Like, that's a small part of your life. But it becomes your whole identity. Like, I've been a police officer for 5 years now, but in my heart, I'm still a soldier. Like,
wow.
Every day I still think about it. You know, there's not a day that's gone by that I don't think about it. So transitioning for me into civilian life, while I was in, I applied for the coppers. So I think by the time I was out of the army, I was only a civilian that didn't have a job for 5 months, maybe. And I was just living off my deployment money. And we were still getting paid by the army because we were on leave.
We took
all our leave. And then I went straight into the police. So that was a successful transition to me, for me, because I still get to use similar skills. I'm still in a paramilitary organization, So I have a new identity. You know, I became a police officer. A lot of guys we know struggle with work because, you know, they either apply for the coppers and couldn't get in, or they want to do private security, or they want to be a personal trainer.
Fireys. That's why you guys make it so bloody hard for civilians to get bodyguard jobs. Yeah.
Sorry, mate.
Oh, don't look at me. No.
But yeah, like, it's unless you get out and realize that you need to find a new purpose, like you're not a soldier anymore. You've got to leave that behind. And the guys you can't leave that behind, they're the ones that keep losing jobs and keep drinking and just, you know, lose relationships because they just can't get over the old days. You know, me and Shane, even though Shane's in the army now, he's a bit older, a bit wiser now, realizes that you need other things in your life to make you a whole person. You know, it can't just be soldiering all the time. You know, you need to branch out. And the same with me, like, even though I've gone to the coppers, I don't take on a police officer as my whole identity. You know, like, I see a lot of coppers that they go live to they live it. They go to parties and all they want to talk about is work. You know, I'm like, fuck, oh, I can never be like
so
that.
Then we all sit around and kick the crap out of it.
So there I am, you know, writing a ticket. Like, shut up, mate. You know, like, I had this one job the other day. No one wants to hear it, mate. Like, around a barbecue. Yeah, so you need to find another purpose and another identity. It can't just be that. Just because you do a job, it's not who you are.
Yeah.
And guys leaving the army need to realize that. While you're in, to be a successful soldier, I think you do need to take on that identity. And
you need to immerse yourself in it.
Yeah, you do. But it's, you know, the army can train you to be an awesome soldier, but they just don't know how to untrain that out of you on the way out.
Well,
there's not much time put into it either. Like, how many months are you trained to be a soldier, and how do you get trained to not be a soldier when you leave?
When we got out, we didn't.
It's interesting, actually, and it always sounds like I'm trying to suck off my unit, but I mean,
title of your sex tape.
Yeah. Yes, that's good. One of the things that our unit's doing is getting guys to do PMEs, so professional. What is it? Professional military education or something like that. Essentially, it's just a person will get tasked with coming out with the topic and then delivering a speech or a
TED talk.
Yeah, kind of like a TED talk. There's a list of topics that you can choose from, or you can pick whatever you want. And guys are really starting to run with that, and like, it's interesting. Like, one guy did it on stoicism.
On what?
Stoicism.
Is that a word?
Yeah,
philosophy.
It's like an ancient. Yeah. Yeah, Shane's right into it.
Yeah. Yep. It wasn't me.
How to be stoic.
Yeah, how to be stoic.
Right.
So, you know, and like, we had a whole range of different things. Like, one of the last ones we did was about DOHAS. So, it's a scheme for people in the military for the government to help contribute to their home loans and things like that and what you're entitled to. So, it's like all kinds of different things, but it's like an opportunity for guys to do something outside of what we normally do, and to develop yourself a bit more, which I think is good because guys are starting to find more things to do outside of work. Like, there's a group of us at work who all have bikes, and we'll do, you know, a Sunday ride somewhere or something like that. And I think finding those things to do outside of work is another really good way to help find things to do when you are transitioning out.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, nice. And there's more and more places to go now. Like, I mean, and a lot more places that can help with that transition. And like Warfighter Coffee and that sort of stuff. So for all those sort of people that want to bring forth job opportunities, like what is it, Operator Edge? No, not Operator Edge. It's Extra Specialist.
And there's a few different places that are starting to get on board more with that, for finding not just veterans but emergency responders as well, finding them employment outside after they've want to transition out. But I think, like, the best advice is, like, take that time seriously and have a plan when you get out, because there's a lot of seminars and things that, you know, aren't mandatory, but, you know, you should go to find out what your options are, you know, any way that you can, what is it, like, transfer some of your skills into civilian qualifications, things like that. Just have a plan.
And just check in on your mates, like, just have that communication.
Yeah. Because that is a hard thing, like Shane alluded to it before, is when you leave and become a civilian, you realise real quick, oh, shit, I don't see my mates.
Yeah.
Like, these are my brothers. I see them every day. And now I don't see them every day. And you don't realise how much you rely on each other until you're not catching up all the time.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that what sort of ideas can you give people to deal with that and sort of find another path as well? Like
I think
don't start a podcast. That's ours.
Yeah, don't do that. I would say, going back to what I was saying before, finding another purpose. Like you got to open your mind, guys. We've worked with it in the infantry, like I said before, they're that engrossed in the culture. I don't want to talk to anyone that's not a soldier, you know. Mm. This is the only stuff, the only stuff I like talking about. It's like you need to realise that you can make other friends. They don't have to be soldiers. There are that many people that have interesting things to say and do and talk about. Like, if you enjoy playing sport, get back into playing sport again, you know. You'll meet people through that, you know, through whatever job you decide to do after. Start being a bit social there and just reconnect with other people and try new things. That's what the advice I'd give to people.
Yeah, I mean, we're still trying to find more places and people who are doing that. So I think we alluded to it last time we did a podcast, but I was told about a couple of places, one near here in Brisbane, mm-hmm. one up near Woodgate, that are run by like old Vietnam veterans, where it's essentially a retreat for guys who've been in the Defence Force to go, and they can go fishing or whatever on like these massive plots of land, stay there, camp there, things like that.
Have you guys heard of Bankstown Retreat? Is it Bankstown?
No.
There's a place out at Lowood for emergency services and ADF. For camping and stuff.
Oh, yep. Okay. Yep. That might have been one of the ones he was talking about. Yeah, that might be it.
Banks Creek Retreat.
Okay. Yeah. No, I haven't heard of it.
Yeah, I'll get you onto it.
Yeah,
that'd be good.
I'll give you the link for the Facebook page. But they have men's nights and women's nights and all that sort of stuff, and you can take your family out camping.
Yeah, that's probably one of the best ideas that I've come across for being able for people to get together, men and women who have served. And especially it's good to see more and more emergency services being brought into the fold with the veterans as well. It's really good.
One thing a lot I notice now is, there's, you know, for years now you always hear about the mental health of soldiers and stuff like that, but yeah, now emergency services, mental health is starting to be talked about a lot, because I find, you know, I've done both, I've been a soldier and a police officer. I'm not good at either, but hey, they keep paying me. But they, like, I've experienced more stress as a police officer than I ever did as a soldier. And, you know, you factor in the adrenaline dump as a first responder, the rosters you work, you know, the shift work that's constantly changing, the unknowns of every job you go into, yeah, you're going to have some mental health issues probably. You know, you're going to be a little bit stressed out. Mm. So, yeah, it's good that mental health in emergency services is starting to be recognised a lot more and get out there.
Yep. There's some really good places out there to help them as well.
Yep.
I heard of a new one called Sirens of Silence.
Oh, okay.
They're based in Western Australia, but they're for emergency services.
Yep.
Personnel. It's they offer counselling separate to the employer counselling.
Yep.
So that the people don't have that fear of.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah, because I know like heaps of coppers do fear the internal system. You know what's in place and talking to anyone there. I know a lot of people like to outsource who they talk to as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Because then they can get the help that they really need and still be employed.
Yeah.
Still that's be right. making money. So for you, how does the military compare to police work?
That's a good question. What's good about the police is I'm doing my job every day. So I'm always using the skills that I was trained to use.
Would you say that because you didn't get your game day in the military, do you think you're living that and making up for that somewhat, or do you feel that that your training is rightfully purposed, like you're actually fulfilling?
Bloody hell, you're asking some good questions, mate. I think you've hang on, mate, I think I'm probably trying to make up. I didn't get my big game day.
You definitely were. Like, you're more conscious of it now.
Yeah.
But you for ages, that's, you were just chasing.
Yeah, and I do that in my job now. Like, any urgent jobs, you know, where there's a critical incident, a violent person, a stolen car, robbery, whatever, I'm chasing. I'm first to go, yep, I'm going straight there and trying to get wherever the action is, I'm trying to get involved with it. And, yeah, I think it is because, you know, I miss my game day in the Army, and that's, I'm constantly chasing it. And like Shane said, I'm very aware that I do that. But that's where I feel my skills, my best skills are at critical jobs like that. I have the training with military and the police training. I feel I'm best suited to those kind of jobs. That's what I'm always going to be gravitated towards. Mm. Yeah.
The word hero gets thrown around a lot.
Ooh.
Not from me, though.
No.
That's you. I get your text, mate. Stop calling me a hero, Shane. Come on, mate.
it threw me off.
Yeah. They're hard to work with.
Yeah, we're very hard to work with.
I'm slowly learning.
So much regret.
For you, Shane, what was it that made you want to get back into the military?
Another good question. I guess I'd reached the point. So when I left, my goal was to join the Fireys. Did not have a solid plan on how that was going to happen. I just decided, hey, look, this will work. So it wasn't until I actually got out that I realized just how difficult and long a process that can be. So eventually I got a job as a auxiliary, like part-time firey out at Gundawindi. And while that kind of started satiating a bit of that desire to do something a bit dangerous and like give back a little bit, it wasn't quite the same thing. The more I thought about it, the more I realized like I was just going to be sitting around just as much. Concurrently to that, like I was having a lot of issues with alcohol, missing all my mates, like, living so far away. And I think it just got to a point where it's like, if I don't go back to the Army, I'm probably going to end up doing something silly to myself. And I just needed to get back around people that I understood, because I was having a lot of dramas with interacting with civilian friends and family and stuff like that as well.
Was that also maybe so that you had that regimented lifestyle again, so it would sort of break you out of that sort of trend, or?
Yeah, probably to a degree. And it definitely did that for a short amount of time. Like once I did get back in and I got back into that lifestyle, I snapped out of it for quite a while. But then within, I think it was about a year, it just went back downhill again. And that's when I really noticed it start to actually affect my work and actually start actively seeking help.
Do you remember what triggered that?
I don't think there was anything that necessarily triggered it. Like, I was involved in the incident when Red died from 2nd 14, the cavalry soldier in Shoalwater Bay. I think it was 2016.
Yeah, you never told me that you're involved in that. Yeah, you didn't tell me that.
Yeah, so because I was involved in that incident, anyone's involved has to go and do like a psych screening just to make sure everything's kosher, everything's going well. Well, I wasn't having any dramas with that or anything, but in the back of my mind, I knew there was something else that wasn't quite right, so I just brought that up with the psychs and started talking to them about that. I think what finally broke the camel's back, as it were, was I was just so sick of feeling like that all the time, of getting really low, and like I figure I can't keep living like this. Like, I've got to find a way to fix it, otherwise, yeah, I can just drink myself to death.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's good that you saw the signs and made the decision that something had to change.
Yeah.
Been there, done that.
Mm.
A lot of people don't have that response, or that they don't have that that moment.
Yeah.
Where and they just sink deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
So
I mean, even that wasn't even my lowest point. You know what I mean? Like, it was still another year and a half before I even started getting proper help and kind of reached my lowest point. There's always the possibility to
best it.
But yeah, it's quite hard. And I think what helped me with that was as we go further down this road as human beings, and especially in the military, and becoming more so in the emergency services as well, the culture of being able to talk about it grows. You feel a bit more comfortable going and seeking help. And for the army, there's or for the defense, there's VVCS, veterans, what does it stand for? Veterans Counseling Service. What are the other V stands for? I can't remember. But same thing, where you can go and talk to psychologists and psychiatrists outside of the scope of the army. And unless you're going to kill yourself or hurt someone else, they're not going to report anything to the army. So you can still kind of carry on with your career in that way. So having those, I guess, what do you call it, facilities and people to talk to kind of outside of the army really made it a lot easier to actually want to go and seek that help. Yeah.
Where would you recommend people start with Veterans Affairs, or
It's called something else now. God, I'm so bad with names.
I can't remember it
either. Yeah. Something Hope or something like that is a good place to start, because it's outside of your chain of command. You know, they're not going to report to the army, obviously, unless you are going to hurt yourself or someone else. Even a mate is a really good place to start. Let someone else know. If no one else knows what you're going through, no one can help you. Just by talking to someone else, you might be able to sort it out that way. Yeah, I think you got to talk about it. That's the only way that's it's.
I think once you and me have realized this, that where we started to really pick up and get better is once you have an understanding of what's going on with yourself and why you are the way you are. That's when you can learn how to treat it and handle it. You know, and like we've realized, because for years we were going through ups and downs. Mm. And once you and me started talking to each other about it and figuring out our issues laid with, you know, basically an identity issue, leaving the army, obviously Shane got back in. Me, like I said before, I will always associate with being a soldier, which is, it will always be a bit of an issue. But for me, that's where I feel my best parts are. But it's still an issue that I feel like that. Once you have an understanding and start talking about it, every time you talk about it, you can talk about it 1,000 times within a week, you will get something out of it and realize something new about yourself. And slowly, once you start picking up these little clues and start putting the puzzle back together, you do feel better. And I think that's, as long as people are talking about it, like Shane said, either to a professional or to some mates, then that's a good place to start.
And to be honest, I have gotten a lot out of therapy, but, you know, the thing that probably saved my life was talking to Tommy. And, like, there were a couple of days when, you know, I had a plan for how I was going to kill myself, and it was only because, you know, luckily Tommy called me, or I, you know, just was over and I called him and we were able to talk through it, that, you know, it just, you know, it went from, like, oh, I'm going to kill myself today to, oh, you know what, well, it's not so bad, like... I think that one day after I talked all the way home, and it's about 30 k's home from work for me. And I was talking.
That's to Tommy. A long time to think.
Yeah. So I was talking to Tommy, and by the time I got to the shop, started to get stuff for dinner, I was like, oh, you know what? You know, life's pretty good. Like, it's all right. And then, like, normally I can't stand pop music and stuff, and they had this song playing in the thing. Normally, like, just ranting and raving against the world, and this woman was whistling. Oh, you know what? That's nice. You know, she's whistling while she works. Oh, this is lovely.
Which is a big thing for Shane, because he's the most cynical person I've ever met. If someone's happy, he's like, what are you happy about? Don't be happy. So that's a big thing for him to like pop music or let someone whistle.
Yeah. But wow. 100%, it went from, I'm going to go park in that quarry and gas myself. But something as simple as just talking to a mate can really help.
Yeah, like I've come across people, even just a guy in the pub come up to me one night and said that his son was sitting in hospital dying.
Oh,
and
shit.
And I'm like, fuck. And he goes, can I have a hug? And I said, fuck yeah, you can have a hug.
Yeah.
And the first thing I said to him was, build yourself a support network.
Yeah.
Don't rely just on one person.
Yeah.
There was a friend of mine who had two friends. One of them committed suicide and the other one tried calling her one night and she didn't answer the phone and then he killed himself.
Oh, fuck.
And it's like, because I think he was relying on that one person all the time, and as soon as that help didn't come through, that was the tipping point.
Yeah.
So it can be exhausting for the person that you're telling as well.
Oh, yeah.
Just remember that.
Yeah.
So,
build
yourself a support network and get multiple people on board so that you can you've got contingency plans to fall back on.
Yeah. So, actually, that's a really good point. I think what stops a lot of people from talking sometimes is they do have that one or two people that they go to when they feel bad and they start to feel a little bit of guilt, like they may be going through a tough time and someone will reach out like, how are you feeling today? And they don't want to tell them because they feel like, oh, I'm just going to bring this person down and I don't want to do that to that person. So they'll just keep it all internal.
That's right.
You know, because they've only got that one person they talk to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but it, like I said, it can be encompassing for the recipient of that information as well. Tired, like, and it's not to say that they're sick of hearing it. It's just they start to live it themselves. Like it's, you know.
And for that person, like, there's only so much you can say.
Yeah,
you know, and they may feel like they're repeating themselves over and over again, which you know is fine. But they may think, oh, am I even really helping this person? It is draining.
Yeah,
you know, to that person, I see it all the time. You know, with mental health jobs that I go to, where they're relying on, you know, a family member, and I talk to the family member and they're like, I don't know what else to do. You know, this is what I've done. This is what I've told them. I'm at my wit's end basically with how to help them. Yeah. So it's draining for everyone. Yeah. But you know, you got to do what you got to do to help them through it.
Yep. Yeah. Well, okay. So where do you see yourself going in the military?
RSMA.
Explain that, mate.
Oh, yeah.
Don't just say that.
That's awesome. Case closed. see you later.
No, I'm kidding. RSMA is like the, what do you call it? Like the Regimental Sergeant Major of the Army. So it's like one under the big dog. No, I'm joking. I'm not.
I was going to say, what? When did you get ambition?
I was like, when were you going to tell me?
I was getting really excited there.
No. Like, I love the job I'm in now as a combat engineer. I'll probably keep doing this job as long as my body will let me. I don't really want to get out again at the moment. More so now because I love the work that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Than at it being my life raft as it was when I got back in. But I think I'll try and ride. So as long as my body will hold out, I'll try and keep doing this job, and then I suppose try and get my commune started, just buy some land somewhere and then...
Your cult, mate. Call it a cult.
It's a commune. Come on. And then, I really just want to just go bush, eh?
Yeah.
And just be away from everyone.
Off-grid.
Yeah, 100%.
That's where we want to live.
In Tasmania.
And he wants everyone to come with him.
Yeah.
Share the costs around.
I'm in.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
I could live out in the middle of the sticks. No.
Yeah. I know, man.
It would be so much fun.
Yeah, 100%. But yeah, like, I don't know, I really can't beat my job at the moment. Like, at the moment, I'm all allowed to touch explosives, but, you know, when you get to, I used to dream as a kid about setting off fireworks and explosions and shit, now I get to do that, like, for a job, it's pretty fucking awesome.
Yeah, family friend of mine is an engineer in New Zealand Army, and he told me a story once of how they blew up a tractor, and I was like, yes, that's very cool.
Yes, you get to blow some cool shit.
Yeah. What about yourself, Tommy?
Mate, at the moment, I'm enjoying just being in first response, you know, the unknown of it all. I have plans. I won't go into what the plans are, I'm working on some things and getting into like a specialist role.
Bit of a mover and shaker, Tommy.
Bit of a mover and shaker, mate, you know me. But I've been a police officer for 5 years now. I'm still enjoying the first response aspect of it. So yeah, I'll just keep doing this and just keep the grind going until I get where I want to be. But I love my job. 100%.
Can I ask if it's more of a tactical role?
It is more of a tactical role.
Yeah, it's
role,
not. I thought that's where it would have headed.
Yeah. That's all I'll say. But yeah, that's what I have to get into soon.
Yeah, awesome. Well, guys, it's been absolutely fantastic to have you in here.
Yeah, mate, likewise.
Yeah, it's been awesome.
It's been, really rewarding to hear firsthand what, because you're pretty much my first deployed military guys that had in here. So, I'm just hoping that more will jump on board. So if anyone has a really interesting story or want to talk about their time in the service, whether it be military or EMS workers, please don't hesitate to contact me at mancave4301@gmail.com. Tommy and Shane, and of course the lovely Miss Shane, thank you for coming in, and I wish you all the best in the future.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, mate. Same to you. Thank you.
We're out.
Fuck yeah.
Guys, thank you very much for joining me on this podcast. I do want to give a bit of a shout out to Tommy and Shane. Thank you guys very much for coming on. It has been an absolutely fantastic episode. Love to have you guys back. I also want to give a shout out to a work colleague of mine. His name is Jutton. He kindly gifted me the two microphones that Tommy and Shane were using tonight. Absolutely fantastic audio. I just need to learn how to use them a little bit better with my mixing. But thank you, Jutton, so much for your donation to the Man Cave. They will go to good use, as you can see. And, yeah, I cannot wait to get more people on the other end of them. Thank you very much. Until next time, peace out.